Oh, this is a great story I wrote today. Mm-hmm. How I escaped from pygmy cannibals.
Pygmy cannibals? Did you really? Was that today?
Yeah, they had me cornered. I'd lost my gun. They'd dropped a net over me from out of a tree. There I was, fighting, struggling, but there was too many of them. They were all over me like ants. How do you think I escaped?
I have no idea. Did I ever tell you about the mad elephant that seized me in his trunk and flung me 1/2 mile? I went back afterwards and measured it.
You're catching on.
This is the emergency podcast system. This is not a test. Movies are bombing all over the country. They are posing as movies you already know. They may already be in your theaters, your neighbor's home, or even your own. Do not panic. Specialists have been dispatched. They will help you identify these pretenders and defend you against this invasion of the remake. Please stand by for further instructions.
Welcome to the Invasion of the Remake podcast, or Isolation of the Podcast, Isolation of the Remake, week 3, and everybody's joining us at home, hopefully in their isolation, or at least recognizing social distancing as best they can. We're happy to be a part of your lives as part of your entertainment during these difficult times, but we are bringing in a lot of fun for April, because it's the Apocalypse. Part 2! This week we're going to be talking about the original Mighty Joe Young from 1949 and the remake from 1998. I mean, that's a 22-year-old remake at this point, but we'll get to that. First, I'm going to introduce the rest of the people. Joining us this week is Sam Stepanenko.
There is no jungle in my living room or jungle preserve, but I am here.
Well, that's good news. I'm glad you're cleaning up nicely. Trish Coughlin, everybody.
Hey, everybody. I could stand being in a jungle right now. I think it would be awesome.
Jeff Omega.
Oh, hello. Yeah, I'm thinking that watching that first movie, you know, you could have enough time to carve out a little stop animation project of your own.
Mm-hmm.
The first movie.
Yeah, the first movie that we're talking about today.
Yeah, okay. I thought the second one was longer and felt longer, so...
The second one was longer.
Yeah.
Oh, no. I mean, the first one, it has stop animation in it.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Absolutely. Yes, it does. And I'm happy to talk about stop animation because I love it, love it, love it. This was actually Ray Harryhausen's first feature. He didn't get the special effects credit, but he did like 90% of the work. And it shows because nobody did the fluid stop animation like he did.
Yeah, yeah, no, you can tell it's Harryhausen. There's no question.
Mm-hmm. It was actually a very welcome surprise that both of these movies kind of accidentally ended up being just watching two masters of their craft just at play with monkeys in both movies. It's very, very mm-hmm. fun. Two very different examples of two very, very talented men.
Who was the special effects? I'm just blanking on the... Rick Baker.
Rick Baker.
That's right. It was Rick Baker for the remake, and... He kind of swore off monkeys, but it would not be his last. He kind of came back for this one, and then he would come back for another film we may be talking about in a couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. But we
absolutely
won't.
He swore off several times, and it didn't work out.
No, the monkeys kept coming back. They were a monkey on his back,
mm-hmm.
or apes, if you will, because I'm sure one asshole out there is going to go, well, they're not monkeys, they're apes. Yes, they are apes.
We know that.
And that's why it's called April.
That's why it's called April Apocalypse, and this is one of the biggest we're going to be talking about right now with Mighty Joe Young. What'd you guys think of these? I actually hadn't seen either of these before, and I got to say, I really enjoyed the 1949. I liked them both, but I definitely enjoyed the 1949 more, even though it's a little more hackneyed. It's the more simplistic storytelling, but... I really dug it. I was smiling, grinning ear to ear, and that stop motion was just, it's amazing how well it holds up still.
I'm in the exact same camp as you. The remake, I'd actually seen, we rented it when it came out. I probably saw it when I was 5. But the original one I'd never seen before, and yeah, it was just delightful. The whole movie, it was written by the same person who wrote King Kong.
Yeah, and Marion C. Cooper.
Yeah, and also Ruth Rose. Yeah, and you really could tell that after a long time, many years after King Kong had come out, that this movie was a little bit, what if King Kong had kind of turned out happier, and kind of the thought games that you play with that. I could absolutely see that being the inception of Muddy Joe Young and how it played out. And it felt very delightful and like it was resolving something that they had started with King Kong.
I'd agree with that, yeah. Sam, what did you think about this?
I think they were both lovely films, and I hated watching them.
Oh, what is that?
Okay, well, now that you're hurling shit at the apes.
No, you know, honestly, they were both really well made, and they were both great stories, but I didn't enjoy the treatment of Joe in either movie. And it just made me feel like, you know, this isn't something that I really would want to watch again. As lovely as they were, and the performances were excellent, and the effects were excellent, and the story was wonderful. It's just one of those movies where even though you recognize how good it is, I just didn't really enjoy it.
Yeah, that's fair.
That's fair.
Yeah, I'm with Sam and like Muddy Joe Young. I found it's like the treatment of Joe in both just enraged me a lot. But I found in like the remake, Ruth Rose was involved in like, I guess, the earlier screenplay of it. And Marion C. Cooper was also involved. But I think there's a couple of notes that they wanted to do in the original. Like Joe didn't get drunk and go on a rampage. I guess Marion C. Cooper had a big argument with the director about that. Mm-hmm. He wanted it to be like a misunderstanding and Joe tries to save the other guy. But I think they finally got that note in the remake where they kind of made the note that Joe is the hero and humans are the villains completely and totally.
You know, I think it still holds up within the original film because of how much they are utilizing him for monetary purposes and not really thinking about the well-being of the ape. At least in the remake, there is some thought to conservation and protecting Joe, even though they are still using him for money to draw people to the conservatory and draw money into the conservatory.
The biggest difference between the two movies I saw was that, as usual, the Disney version had to add a big bad guy.
Yeah.
Because you had a villain in that remake that wasn't present in the original. The original, I think, covered, they did show that that humans were still responsible for what was happening to Joe because they did get him drunk, right? Ultimately, they were responsible for his actions by acting like assholes. So it's still there. But yeah, the addition of the villain changed the story quite a bit for me.
It does, but I think it focuses your anger at least a certain individual. It's a little tougher in the original where you're, okay, well, now you got guys who should have been thrown out. You've got these club owners who are manipulating him, and there's a little more focus because of adding the villainous characters, which were the poachers at the beginning of the movie, and 12 years later out for revenge when they finally discover, oh, this is the ape that ate my fingers.
Yeah, I know it's there for sure. There's no question that it is a better way of sort of focusing your anger at a specific individual. And I think that's why I kind of liked it just a smidge better, because it just wasn't generally all humans are bad and mistreating Joe. It's humans are pretty inconsiderate of Joe, but then there's this one person that you can be really mad at.
Yeah.
Well, and I liked it because it made a highlight on poachers themselves, like the whole problem of poaching was in Muddy Joe Young. And as well as I'm absolutely positive there's a part in the script where he's like going, oh, the poacher's like, no, I can get justice. Because in the original, they have like a court case and they're like, oh, we just have to shoot Joe because that's the right thing to do. I feel they kind of made that very big point where it's like, oh, no, dumb people think that justice is something that just it profits them. Like they're like, oh, we made a mistake, but it's somebody else can pay.
Yeah, and that really hurts. It sort of hits the heart of why I didn't love these movies as much as I would have liked to. As wonderful as they are and as well made as they are. And they're both really great family films. There's that ignorance in both movies that really I just found really frustrating and kind of diminished the film for me in that sense because I was so frustrated in both films.
Okay, I get that. I didn't have the frustration because we do see kind of Joe get redeemed in the eyes of people and get back to his natural habitat as well as a result of it. So yeah, we do get the better ending.
For me, both of them were kind of stories about how people are very quick to judge Joe because, like, they're ready to put their fears onto him and judge him before they know anything. But both movies are kind of an example of, like, at the end of both of them, Joe saves the kid, and then people are kind of shown that they were maybe too quick in their assumptions about him. And that was kind of the takeaway for me for both of them anyway.
Yeah, totally. Well, the initial conceit is when you see such a giant gorilla is fear. I mean,
absolutely.
Most people would have fear with a normal sized gorilla, let alone a 15 foot, one ton gorilla. Yeah, that's going to be natural fear. And we see that in both films as people kind of react to it and then kind of get used to it as it's being docile. And in the original film, we do see some people being assholes and some bad booking, as it yeah. were. But it's that natural fear that humans have and that natural fearful reaction to something like that. So if it does go out in anger, rather than investigate the problem, they figure, oh, we got a very dangerous rabid beast we need to put down, which in both films, I was like, just ship him back to Africa.
Right?
Yeah.
Well, yes. What you see in both movies is they've got this giant ape right there. And all these people are gathered around like, oh my God, he went crazy. We were right there. Yeah, you were right there.
Yeah.
You decided to have a party right next to a 15-foot ape and you wondered why it went fucking wrong?
Yeah. I mean, this is well after King Kong, about a decade after King Kong, although it has a lot of the similar themes, where it's kind of the extension of where the end of the movie, where he's a showpiece, that's kind of like the second act of Mighty Geo Young, at least the original. Mm-hmm. And they've made him this stage act in this rather massive and yeah. intricate nightclub, which I guess existed in the 40s and early 50s. It was quite something. That was one hell of a set piece, I must admit. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they had lions and tigers and elephants running around in this nightclub behind glass mm-hmm. and stuff. And post-Jurassic Park generation are going, oh yeah, this is going to be a problem before any problem yeah. actually arises.
And it's somehow the animal's fault.
Right?
But these dumb fucks don't think about that, do they?
Yeah.
No, and that's the issue I had all along, is I spent almost 90 minutes being frustrated and angry at human beings for that last 10 minutes of the film where they actually get to see Joe as he really is. I mean, I'm keep coming back to it, but you're kind of hitting the nail on the head there, is they do a great job of showing how reprehensible human beings in this movie are, for the most part.
Well, you're supposed to be angry.
Absolutely, yes. Sam.
And that's why I don't enjoy it, though. I don't like being angry.
Okay. I'll give you that one. Okay, well, I think it's a good time to break, and we will run the original 1949 trailer. And as you can imagine, it's got the words emblazoned over some music, but there is some voiceover here, so enjoy this classic 1949 trailer for Mighty Geo Young.
Kind of movie you're waiting to see as John Ford and Marion C. Cooper present Mighty Joe Young, whose sensational exploits will startle you, thrill you, electrify you with hair-raising excitement and suspense. See Mighty Joe Young as he savagely resists capture in his native Africa. See the most fantastic relationship between beast and beauty. A mere girl mastering a primitive giant. See Mighty Joe Young, enraged by Hollywood pranksters, destroy Filmland's swankiest nightclub on a fabulous Sunset Strip.
Mighty Joe Young.
The picture that's alive with the most sensational action thrills ever filmed.
Mightier than King Kong, Mighty Joe Young.
right. That was Mighty Joe Young from 1949, the original story by Marion C. Cooper, who we probably brought up because he wrote the original King Kong. He wrote it, produced it, directed it, the whole nine yards. We actually talked about that in episode 78, was King Kong. The screenplay was by Ruth Rose, also wrote King Kong, Son of Kong, and She, which we may talk about someday.
Nice.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
The director was Ernest B. Shudsack? Let's go with Shudsack.
Shudsack.
Shudsack? Well, that sounds much worse.
Yes.
He directed episode 78, King Kong, Son of Kong, and The Monkey's Paw. He had a real theme going there. And also, maybe we'll tackle this one day just because I like the title, Dr. Cyclops.
And didn't he also direct The Most Dangerous Game?
I don't have that app open anymore, so I wrote down the ones that interested me the most.
When I was looking at his director credits, I saw the Most Dangerous Game on there. And yeah, The Most Dangerous Game is great. You know, the classic Man Hunts Man movie.
Yeah, been done multiple times. Starring Terry Moore. No, not the awesome comic book writer and artist, but the much older Terry Young, who plays Jill Young in this movie. She's still acting in her 90s. You might remember her from Peyton Place and The Devil on Wheels. I just wanted to add that in there because it's such a cool title. Ben Johnson. No, not the disgraced sprinter. The other one plays Greg, and we talked about him in episode 197.
The Getaway.
That's right. Robert Armstrong played Max O'Hara, and he was also in King Kong, which we talked about again in episode 78, and some couple of really fun ones that I wanted to bring up. There's one called The Mad Ghoul, and this one's not problematic at all. Captain China.
Oh, my. Oh, there's a Stephen King joke there. Captain Trips, Captain China.
Some jokes write themselves.
Yes.
And, of course, we can't forget Mr. Joseph Young, who plays himself in his only screen credit for this iteration of Joe Young. But I thought that was cute that they put the stop motion ape in the credits when so many people were not.
He was almost in another film. But that didn't pan out.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, Mighty Joe Young Tarzan. Was supposed to get a sequel with Tarzan, absolutely.
I would have loved that, but unfortunately this movie was not a success. Oh, actually, I'll bring that up right now. The budget of that movie was a fairly large budget for 1949. It was $1.8 million, wow. But it just came in just under $2 million to $1.95 million for the box office, so... Yeah, that's a disappointing box office. At least they made their money back, but that's definitely a disappointing box office. And incidentally, $1.8 million converts to just under $24 million in today's dollars.
Well, without promotion, as you would say, they didn't make their money back.
No. I imagine talent cost a lot less back then, so the budgets were a little more concise, and advertising TV was... I'm not even sure it kicked off yet at this point. So
no, it didn't, but you still promoted.
Newspaper, print, that sort of thing. So
newspaper, print, but they also had the actors.
This probably did cover it, but they made no real money on it. This movie also starred Frank McHugh as Windy, and he was in a movie called The Hoodlum Saint. I wrote down a bunch of these because I just some great titles here. Douglas Fowley played Jones, and we talked about him in episode 91.
Didn't get that one, Jay. He had 300-some credits. I wasn't going through them.
Oh, trust me. These were a nightmare to go through. He was in episode 91 where we talked about Walking Tall. He was also in, this one's for you, Trish, Killer Shark.
Nice.
Yeah. Dennis Green was Crawford. He was in iteration of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, one of the ones with sound. Paul Gafoyle was Smith. He was in Grapes of Wrath. Nestor Paiva was Brown, and we did probably talk about him in episode 100.
300 credits, no.
Creature from the Black Lagoon. Regis Toomey was John Young and the father of Jill in one of the early scenes where we see a young Jill. basically by this baby ape. And he was in The Voyage of the Bottom of the Sea, the film version. And Laura Lee Michael played young Jill. And she was in a movie called Paid in Full. James Flavin played Schultz. And we talked about him very recently in episode 232.
300 credits, no.
That's a t-shirt now. James was in It's a Mad, 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 Mad World. We talked about that just a couple weeks ago in episode 232. And there is a cameo by Tor Johnson where these wrestlers and boxers are in a tug-of-war. And
It's not Tor Johnson.
Oh, they mislabeled that? Miswrote that?
Yeah, it's not Tor Johnson.
I didn't think so, because I looked at him like, wow, that guy's familiar, but I didn't think it was Tor, and I was a little baffled when I saw that written down. I'm like, oh, maybe I just didn't recognize him, and he was a lot thinner.
Yeah. Lower down in the IMDb, it corrects it.
Oh, okay. Well, then scratch Tor Johnson off of that list. If anybody wants to check it out, we did talk about Tor in episode 72, Plan 9 from Outer Space.
Yeah, but that one very, very fun thing, though, with the credits is all of the strongmen in Muddy Joe Young were actual pro wrestlers at the time. And all of their stage names that they announced them as were their actual wrestling names. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's what the stable looks like at the time.
They were all fairly big, beefy men, but not by today's standards.
Yeah, some great character, though.
Yeah, but they're not going to be able to best a big, beefy gorilla, especially as big as Mighty Joe Young. Now, as I said, this movie starts off with a young Jill pawning her possessions to buy this young baby ape that has been captured by some of the locals, and she wants it as a pet. And trades her dad's flashlight for it, which I kind of like how that kind of comes back around as a way to signal for Mighty Geo Young in the remake.
I was just about to mention that as well. That's my favorite callback to the original, is the way they reference the flashlight and make it part of the story.
They were very good at taking those small things and maneuvering them in different ways within the remake. I mean, the remake really does everything we ask it to do. And takes some of these small elements and utilizes them in much more unique ways.
Oh, I totally agree. And again, like I said, these are both wonderful films. Like, they're both really well put together films and both really great watches. It's, like I said, my feelings aside, they are wonderful films.
I was actually astounded how well the 98 holds up. Because I'm like, okay, this is going to be CG kind of practical mix, but boy, nothing really stood out to me. It looked really good. And again, yeah, Rick Baker.
You know what? And this is what I find funny is I look at movies sort of around this time and around the 2000s with like CG, and it looks better than it does now to me sometimes.
Yeah, this is kind of one of those cases.
It looks like we've taken a step back. Yeah, it looks like we've taken a great step back recently in how to get this shit done.
You know, I was actually watching, I believe it was Fangoria's Blood and Guts. It was an older YouTube series hosted by Scott Ian. He was interviewing Rick Baker at his house, going through a lot of his like diorama setups of movie stuff he's worked on. And he had mentioned that one of the three things that he really wanted to accomplish in his career was a screen accurate, completely lifelike giant gorilla. And with Mighty Joe Young, he kind of felt like that was his best work on a gorilla in terms of what you could achieve with practical effects.
So. I think so. His, I think, emotes more than the Harryhausen, despite Harryhausen's being very expressive as well. It can kind of be a little cartoony at times, but I find Harryhausen's actually behaves more like an ape would than the Rick Baker one, even though the Rick Baker one looks spectacular.
Well, yeah, they did. They humanized him to a certain extent, and they even do that with that first scene where Bill Paxton's character, O'Hara, is chasing Joe, and he uses the chain to stop the truck. And then he kind of suggests that with his size comes an additional intelligence, almost. At least that's kind of the impression I got.
Yeah. Well, they do try to explain it as a rare form of a recessive gene of gigantism that runs within his line that became active with him. It was interesting how they utilized all that. Now, Greg in this movie, he's basically a cowboy, hired hand for Max O'Hara. And in the remake, they've kind of merged those two characters, with Bill Paxton as Greg O'Hara, which is a mashing of their two names. Now, Max O'Hara in the original, he is a promoter, essentially. He puts together nightclubs, he puts together their acts, and he's always looking for that next thing. And this week, his brain is fixated on Africa theme, jungle theme. And he wants stuff for the nightclub and gets word of this giant ape. And boy, that's hard to put down. You know, he goes to Africa. Mighty Joe Young actually attacks the camp because they had been capturing wildlife. And I get the feeling Mighty Joe Young doesn't like the lions very much. I think there's a backstory there that we just don't know.
Yeah, and that was a change I liked, because in the remake, yeah, Joe's actually freeing the leopard that they caught, or the cheetah that they had caught, and I liked that better. It gave me a better feeling about Joe, is that he is a protector of the area, versus his interaction with the lion, where the lion actually bites him and he gets angry.
Yeah, I think his original intent was to rescue, and then when he got bitten, then he just got pissed off.
Yeah, like when I first saw him like come into that clearing and saw the box, it looked like he was just going to try and open it. And then it went a different way. And I was like, oh, that's not awesome.
Yeah.
The original one, I think, is kind of caught, even though I do like it more than the remake, I do think it is caught a little bit between being a movie that's trying to humanize Joe and make him a lovable character. But at the same time, it's a giant gorilla movie. And, you know, you have to have giant gorillas fight other monsters and animals. And, you know, you have to have excitement with them wreaking havoc. So I think that the original one kind of has a harder time kind of making the two of those mesh, and the remake kind of does it a little better.
I was actually always, every time we got into Harryhausen's animation and stuff and how well, and actually how surprised I was of how well they were meshing live action lions with the animatronic stuff. You would spot it, but it works remarkably well, and it still looks pretty decent even by today's standards, and he would only get better as time went on. Those scenes were pretty good. Now, the lions, there was actually a story I read online about a cameraman who was in a cage. So when they were doing the nightclub scene and the lions are running around, one of the lions got a little unruly and grabbed his trainer by the neck. And so this cameraman comes out of his cage and just bops him in the face, this lion in the face, and the lion runs back into its cage. That could have gone another way.
And the cameraman is like, I think the lion was just so taken aback that I actually just hit him in the face. bad lion. What I think is what they did in the kind of the remake, I think Marion C. Cooper, because I was reading a couple things about him, he clashed with the director on a lot of stuff, I guess, with like Mighty Joe Young. One of them being stuff like the director's like, oh, it has to be a drunk gorilla. And Marion C. Cooper's like, no, he should get in trouble for trying to help somebody. So I think Marion C. Cooper himself was in conflict with the director to try and humanize Joe, but the director kept pulling it in that other direction. And that's why you see that push-pull.
I didn't enjoy the drunk stuff either, and he wanted to have another ape in the final scene. He didn't like the big fire either, but he wanted to have another ape, basically an evil ape, that Mighty Joe Young would fight. I'm not sure if that would have sent the right message either. It probably would have been exciting, if nothing else.
One thing I did really love with the original one was with the fire, when they tinted the film.
Mm-hmm.
That was very effective and cool.
That threw me off for a second. I'm like, oh, what? Am I watching the same movie still?
It was a little weird, wasn't it?
It was startling.
Once I realized what they were doing, but it goes red before you actually see the fire. But there was no color yet, so this was a pretty revolutionary way to introduce color into the movies, just by tinting the film. I guess, I mean, it probably worked at the time. It was a simple effect to do to give you kind of some heat onto the scene, because black and white just looks naturally cool. So by tinting the film, it does feel warmer.
Yeah, and you know, you could get away with some basic lighting within the house to make it feel like it's still on fire with that tint.
Now, okay, back to the story here. He's been taken to this nightclub, and we've hinted at things that have gone on where the audience was starting to huck things at Mighty Joe Young on the stage, and whoever one he picked up would win a round of champagne or whatever, and these drunk guys started throwing bottles at him. So of course that was pissing him off.
Yeah. So
all of us should have pissed him off.
Yeah,
don't throw shit at me.
So when they get him drunk, he goes a bit wild and breaks through his cage after these guys and wreaks a lot of havoc. And they do wind up subduing him through Jill. Jill's always the one that kind of brings Mighty Joe Young down. And later in the movie, they are basically trying to keep him from his death sentence. So they plan a jailbreak. And they're misleading the cops a little bit, trying to get ahead of them so they can take him out of state and hopefully find a plane back to Africa. But we got to stop at this burning orphanage that just happened to happen there. And that was the awkward thing. It just pops out of nowhere in that story. And I did like how they paid homage to that by still doing something different, where Mighty Joe Young's drawn to this park by one of these spotlights, right? And he thinks in his mind it associates it with Jill's flashlight is trying to call him. So he's going to this park, and through him going through the park and smashing the light, when he doesn't find Jill, it actually sparks some flames, and then the park starts going up.
Oh, wait.
No, that's...
Oh, no, no, that was... No, I'm,
the poacher shoots
the poacher shoots it. He does smack the light, but he doesn't actually turn it off. The poacher shoots the light and causes the fire. That's correct.
Because Joe actually doesn't do any harm to anybody or anything. Aside from that car, that Mercedes-Benz was awesome.
You know, that would have worked better if we'd seen some douchey owner or something for it. That had been a joke. It's been set up more, but everybody was taking a lot of joy out of him smashing that car.
Yeah,
it just felt like we didn't get the full joke.
Yeah.
I did like how proud of himself he felt.
Yes. Oh, it was that look on his face. He's like, finally, I did it.
I liked how kids weren't afraid of him.
Mm-hmm.
They were all
Then they zoom into the one guy, and then all the music stops, and he says, fat.
Yeah.
Very late 90s, yeah. That might have been old slang in the 98.
Yeah. What's funny is the one bit with all the girls are screaming and they're in that open top kind of Jeep-esque vehicle, and he's like, I'm just going to move this here like a handbasket.
And the one girl's like, that was awesome.
Yeah.
I don't know how I would have reacted to that myself.
There's a lot more humor in the remake, and I enjoyed that. And I'm not sure if you guys felt the same way about the last act of the original, but there was a lot of, oh, come on moments in the last act. It felt like it was
really
trying to get that hour and 30-minute runtime.
Yeah, they were milking that final orphanage fire for all it was worth. That building was crumbled to its foundation.
Yeah.
Walls, all, it's like, oh, he's rescued the kid. No, the wall's got to fall on Joe. And it's like, oh, my God. Yeah. But in a way, it all kind of comes back around in the remake, where the Ferris wheel does the same thing and he takes the big fall. We're all worried about him, but having watched the original, he'll be fine.
Yeah. No.
Well, I didn't know. I watched the original. I'm like, oh, my God, they're going to do it. They're going to do the horrible thing. And I was crying because I'm like, no. But then they didn't. And I was like, okay, phew, we get the happy ending, because I thought they were going to go dark for some reason.
Yeah, I didn't remember how it ended. I was worried as well.
I had the same worries about the 49 because, watched them in the proper order. Mm-hmm. And knowing how the early 50s and this I think was before McCarthyism, but the Universal Monsters dictate was already there of the monster always has to die, but they weren't using him as in a monstrous way. He never kills anybody. He may hurt some people. He hucks some people around, but he never hurts anybody.
Oh, when you talk about...
he never kills anybody.
I just have one. He doesn't kill anybody, but there's a couple points where you see the lions landing on stuff, and I'm like, were they just throwing live lions?
I was wondering that too. Yeah. I mean, when you think about the time, the mistreatment of animals in film is marked in history, so... I didn't read anything about it, but it certainly looked like some lions were getting catapulted into the scene.
Just thrown onto a table.
One of them lands on his side on a table. I thought it was supposed to be a stuffed lion.
No, he gets up and he's like, oh,
Yeah.
There's the other shot where they basically covered the floor in castor oil and then slid a lion across the room.
Right?
That at least was funny. That's like watching an animal going across some wax linoleum, but I'm sure he was fine. But again, he looked like he was pushed into the scene and or cat rocketed into the scene. And yeah, I don't really want to know how they wound up doing that. And I wouldn't be surprised if a lion ripped some dude to shreds on that set and we just don't know about it.
Yeah, like when the lion grabbed the trainer, now I know why.
Yeah.
Because I fucking wouldn't.
Well, yeah. We know that Miriam C. Cooper, back with King Kong, wanted the movie to star a real gorilla, just larger. So he probably was just all for that wow factor of... Because that's something we forget about, is the wow factor of seeing exotic animals on a big screen in that time when... That would have been a very new and exciting thing.
Well, I mean, when we were talking about the alligator people just a few weeks ago, and we were always amazed that there's an actor and then suddenly something snapped at her and like, holy shit, I didn't even see that there. And it was a real gator. And, you know, these actors being in real jeopardy. And I have no doubt in my mind there were actors and probably crew in real jeopardy on these sets.
Yeah.
Actually, that's something that we forgot about is with Mighty Joe Young as a baby in the original, one of the very, very few times that a real gorilla is actually had been in a movie, the baby gorilla at the beginning. And it was actually pretty crazy.
But yeah, it was like, I love the look of that because I'm like going, oh, like you're just so cute. Like you're just like, there's that humanizing element that you kind of needed and you can only really get with a real gorilla.
Yeah. I do know that one thing I'm wondering, because I couldn't actually find any information about it. I know that the reason they were able to have a real gorilla at the beginning was because they were able to travel to Africa to get some shots with some animals. So I'm wondering if anything featuring an African animal was shot in Africa and the rest back over in Hollywood.
There's actually that original scene with the cowboys. There's part of that footage was actually shot for Valley of the Guanji, which was meant to be a follow-up of King Kong, but they wound up never doing it. It would happen again later in the 60s, and it would be Harryhausen who would do it. But that original footage that was shot was reused for Mighty Joe Young.
Interesting.
Yeah. Ooh. So
maybe that's why they wrote the cowboys in, is just to use that footage.
Yeah. Yeah, well, Ben Johnson was a real-life cowboy, and you could certainly see by his acting ability at this point in his career.
Yeah, he would have been real popular at county fairs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, he did a lot of westerns. He's a bit of a character actor, but he was really good in this. I enjoyed him.
Really?
He was really good.
You thought he was really good?
He's better than the guy who played Max O'Hara.
Oh, I loved Max.
Actually, you know,
Max was so over the top.
That's what I loved about him. He was like a wrestling promoter. Well, he was a promoter. Yeah, exactly.
I love
like the circus guy.
Yeah.
At the very end, when he was just like, when they finished his sign, he's like, bigger, it needs to be bigger. It's great.
I do like at the end where he finally collaborates with Jill to get Mighty Joe out. Like that kind of switch in character where he sort of redeems himself, where he's like, I made a mistake. My bad. I'll help you out.
Yeah, well, and I mean, he would have lost millions on the destruction of that. I mean, you would have thought maybe not, but he realized that he went too far, and it was nice to see that character be redeemed. And like we said earlier, there were no real focused bad guys in this movie. He was doing some selfish things, and through his gift of gab, kept making the stay longer and longer. He had promised stars and fame to Jill and Mighty Joe Young. And of course, Joe Young, it was just miserable while he's in Los Angeles. He stops eating and through this whole and being caged, and she's more and more upset. And she's after about 10 weeks, she's like, oh, we got to take him back. And Max convinces her for like 7 more weeks before anything really goes really bad again.
Yeah, it's crazy. Like, it's sort of like she's trying to get him out. But I'm like, I could see why they put that also in the remake where Jill's like, no. Like, she's a bit more forceful in her no to what's happening in Joe.
Well, her character in the remake's a little older as well. She's about 17 in the original film, and I would place her around 22 in the remake.
I think that her character, a little bit as well, she's kind of the voice of a lot of the problems or questions that people writing the remake had about the original, I feel. like in the original one, she's just like, hey, get the fuck off my property. And then they show up again. She's like, hey, well, you know, why not? Let's be friends.
And then yes.
You know, in the sequel or in the remake, she's like, you know, she's like, get the hell away from me. And she's like, you know, she stands up for herself a lot more, but because mm-hmm. it's, you know, she's more modern.
Well, she's been isolated yeah. for so long in the original, well, for both films, really. But it's through Greg's persistence that even happens. He's fascinated by this ape and taken with her. And this, knowing that she's 17, maybe inappropriate romance blossoms.
Yeah.
Because the much older cowboy. But, hey, there was like 20 years between Bill Paxton and Charlize Theron as well. So, yes.
20. That's a lot of years.
Yeah.
That is. It's a bit of an ick factor there for sure.
Yeah. Actually, when me and Leo are watching the first one yesterday, so she has her own ranch. You know, she fends for herself. She has a giant gorilla for a best friend. And this mm-hmm. guy comes up and he says, hey, let me take you to America. Everything's amazing. Everything's really great. Mm-hmm. You know, you're going to have the best time. And Leah is like, it's like, oh, man, it's going to be a wake-up call. Like, hey, welcome to 1920s America. Where, you know,
yeah.
where women don't have rights and can't do anything.
Yeah.
To go from, you know, owning your own ranch, as, you know, financially independent woman in the 1920s or 1940s, I guess.
She learns pretty quickly that, yeah, not much there. But thankfully, they need her because she's the only one who can really control Joe. Although Greg mm-hmm. gets there as well mm-hmm. when trust is built. And I like how that builds as well in the remake, which I think is a good time to run the trailer for. How about it?
Yes.
Absolutely.
All right, let's run the trailer for Mighty Joe Young from 1998.
In the classic tradition of Disney entertainment comes this year's holiday movie event. They were orphaned from childhood.
Promise me, protect him. I promise.
Best friends for life.
He's playing with you.
Hide and seek.
You found me!
Good thing Joe didn't want to play doctor.
You think he's okay back there?
He's doing fine.
Now, after 20 years...
Look at him. He won't eat. If he stays in here, he'll die.
Their greatest adventure is about to begin.
Oh, my God.
All right, Jose.
Needs me.
Once you meet him, you'll never forget.
Joe!
Disney's Mighty Joe Young.
Can you get him to put me down?
Joe, drop him.
All right, that was Mighty Joe Young from 1998. The screenplay for this version was by Mark Rosenthal, who is probably best Ooh. Known for writing Jewel of the Nile, Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country, and the Planet of the Apes remake from 2001. He co-wrote this with Lawrence Connor, his writing partner. He's got some really good stuff in his credits and some really bad stuff in his credits. So
yeah, some pretty bad stuff in his credits.
I love Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country, and The Jewel of the Nile was a huge hit. So
very true.
I quite enjoyed that movie as well. Directed by Ron Underwood, who has directed some of my favorites, including City Slickers and Tremors. And we talked about him in episode 168.
The Year Without a Santa Claus.
Ah, Sam's back with us. Awesome.
Yes.
He does not have 300 credits.
That's got to be a t-shirt.
I wrote it down.
Perfect. Bill Paxton stars in this movie as Greg O'Hara, the kind of mashup between Greg and Max O'Hara. Being a conservationist, he's the one who convinces Jill to bring Joe back to the States to be protected because there are poachers in Africa, which they wind up going back to at the end of the movie. But
mm-hmm. yeah.
Apparently during that time, its stay in the U.S., it became less of a problem. Charlize,
well, I guess if it's a nature conservation, there would be better policing, I guess.
Yeah, her GoFundMe really paid off on that one, didn't it?
That crowd sure had great pockets.
They had some deep pockets in 1998 to buy her a reserve in Africa. Charlize Theron was Jill Young, the titular character. We've talked about Charlize a few times. The first time was in episode 91.
The Italian Job.
And
Reindeer Games?
And well, in 117 was Reindeer Games. Absolutely.
Yes. Okay.
Did you want to cover Bill's crossover there, Jay? We've talked about him twice.
Shit. I can't believe I didn't bring those up. Yes, I do have them written down. We actually have talked about Bill Paxton a couple of times on the show. The first time was in episode 83.
Weird Science.
And then again in 176, my favorite.
Near Dark. I was waiting for Trish to do it.
Oh,
sorry.
Yes. I didn't. I was like, oh, my God. I'm trying to go in order in my head, and I'm not getting there.
Yeah, because I stepped on Weird Science there. Do you want to do the Weird Science, Trish?
Okay, 1, 2, 3.
Weird Science. We still can't do it right, but
from my phone and from my hand. I'm just gonna leave this as is. It's so weird. All right, I'm gonna have trouble with this one. The villain of this movie was Raid Rade Zerbajia. Sure, we have talked about before in episode 139.
I missed it. I'm sorry.
That would have been Quarantine. He was in Quarantine, the remake of Wreck.
Oh, yeah.
And our audience will definitely recognize him. He's very much has become that guy you saw in that thing that one time. Mm-hmm. And he's very identifiable because he's got that hairy look and has that accent from, I'm sure where he's from. I want to say...
angry Middle Eastern man.
That's the guy.
Or angry Middle European man. You just cast him.
That's exactly it. That's who you cast. Peter Firth was Garth, and he was in Life Force and Hunt for Red October. David Paymer has graced our show many a time. He plays Harry Rubin, who is basically the head honcho at this conservationist park that Joe is taken to. Now, he still has his corporate masters to answer to, but he runs the park. And he's another one of those, that guy you saw in that thing that one time. And he's been on the show a lot because the first time we talked about him was in episode 38.
That would be Point Blank and Payback.
Payback, yes. He was in Payback. Yeah. And then we talked about him again in episode 152.
No Way Out.
That's correct. And episode 199.
Oh, so much fun. I actually name dropped this week. Howard the Duck.
Howard the Duck, yes. He was also in Ron Underwood's City Slickers as well. So Ron Underwood always brings back a lot of his cast. Regina King was Cecily Banks, and you've probably seen her most recently in The Leftovers, which Jeff lent to me recently, and most recently in HBO's The Watchmen television series.
Oh, yes. Cool.
Robert Wisdom was Kwai. He was in Ray Face Off and is also in The Watchmen television series on HBO. Naveen Andrews is Pindi. This is a fairly early role, and hasn't quite filled out as much yet, but we'd go see him most famously in Lost and Sense8 most recently, but we have actually talked about him before. He was in another movie we covered in 125.
My favorite character in the remake, for Rollerball.
That's right.
And he was the best character in that movie.
I think so, too, yeah. Lawrence Pressman was Dr. Baker, and he's been around for a while. He's been in things like 9 to 5, Shaft, and American Pie. Linda Pearl was Dr. Ruth Young, the mother of the character Jill Young, and most people would recognize Linda Pearl from The Office. Mika Boorman was the young Jill Young. Also got the flashback scene at the beginning of the film, and most people would recognize her from Dawson's Creek, Blue Crush, and The Ward.
Did anyone see that movie?
Which one? The Ward? I have a disc of it in my library, and every year I'm going to, this is the year I'm going to cover it for 31 Days of Horror, and then it goes back on the shelf because I don't watch it.
I think I've seen it.
So I have it, and I'm sure that's how it goes for a lot of people. I've got it. Never watched it.
I don't know how many times I've, you put it on and then you don't know what happens and you're just not watching it anymore.
Oh, I can't even get to the putting the disc into the machine part. So Jeffrey Blake was Vern, and we talked about in episode 48.
got me on that one. I didn't get that far into the credits.
That was The Last Starfighter. The John Alexander, who is does a lot of the physical work and the mocap for Mighty Joe Young. He played Gorillaz quite a bit. That's why I wrote him down, because he was in Planet of the Apes remake and Gorillaz in the Mist as well. So he's used to playing Gorillaz at this point. And interesting, because I kind of made that association with Dr. Ruth Young, Jill's mom, is that very much that Jane Goodall. Was that the person who did a lot of the Watching the Apes? And so there was very much that type of character, which I thought was a very natural way to start the film, is why they're there. And Vern Troyer was the double for the baby version of Mighty Joe Young. Now, there were two cameos in this movie from the original film, and that would have been Terry Moore showing up with Ray Harryhausen in a cameo sequence. Did you guys catch that?
No.
Yeah. Oh, well, Trish caught it, and I know Sam caught it. Because, Trish, where did you see the scene?
Oh, I saw the scene. It's during that big charity ball event.
That is correct.
Terry Moore is like sitting there going like, she reminds me of someone. And then Ray Harryhausen is like, you when you were younger.
Yeah, it was very meta.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's great.
And of course, yeah, if you don't know what Ray Harryhausen looks like, and why would most people? And I mean, a 17-year-old Terry Moore versus, she would have been probably in her 60s or later 70s at this point. Of course, you wouldn't recognize them if you didn't know they were there, so.
And there's one thing I didn't notice until just while you were reading the credits there. Do you think that Ruth Young was named after Ruth Rose, the original writer of the film?
Absolutely.
I think so.
Yeah.
It would make sense, right?
Yeah. I think you're onto something there. I never even thought about it when I wrote the stuff down. But yeah, that totally makes sense. They were using character names specifically, at least the ones that exist in the film, when they mashed Greg O'Hara together. So yeah, no, that totally makes sense. I think so.
Mm-hmm. I like little nods like that.
Yeah, and I, you know, when you think about it, you know, here's a female writer in the late 40s for film. Like, just women in general in the film industry was pretty small.
Yeah. Well, it still is, but like 33.
Yeah, yeah. So I mean, she's a very important figure as far as classic film goes. Absolutely,
yeah, absolutely,
and a pioneer. Okay, so this movie goes a little differently. Starts off very much with the Jane Goodall type. They're secretly watching these apes, but Jill likes to play hide and seek with this one who she's nicknamed Joe. They do hint that can't be Joe. Joe, that's too big. Joe's just a baby. So there's already hints that this is going to be one big ass ape.
I thought it was adorable when he learned how to roar.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They had lots of little just like fun sequences or heartwarming sequences and genuinely funny ones in this movie as well. But
yeah, it's incredible how much delight that you can get from, like, you know, just a hunk of like plastic and fake fur, and it's really masterful.
Oh, that's our own imagination just kind of kicking in, right? And of course that scene goes badly as the poachers break into the camp and Ruth tries to scare them off. This is when Joe Young's mom is shot and he becomes an orphan. Ruth is also shot in the process. The villain Strasser is trying to take the baby. He's like, okay, this is my prize. And the baby chews off his thumb and his shooting finger, as he liked to say, my trigger finger.
Yep.
That's kind of a sign later on when we see the character again, when he's got the prosthetic and he's sworn revenge on this ape. Like, how are you even going to find it in the jungle? But when they start making associations through Jill, who's sworn to take care of Joe and has stayed on the land and tried to protect it, once it becomes a little more public knowledge, initially Strasser doesn't believe in a giant ape. He's like, well, that's ridiculous. And there is a legend on this mountain of this big protector, which is associated with Joe Young. That does come back around right at the end of the movie when he gets to that land becomes a reserve.
During the point where, Joe bites off those fingers, Jill finds him at that moment and she hears him say that he bit off my thumb and my trigger finger. So she has that knowledge from way back when, which can come back later so she can catch them before they get too far. Which I kind of like it's a very traumatic event. Like, they both become orphans at the same time, which I also think is a callback to the orphanage scene from the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's just much like the keys that Garth is always rattling, that big chain of metal mm-hmm. that he's rattling around to rile up the animals. That is an associated trauma for Joe.
Yeah.
Which comes back later and riles him up when he hears, associates that sound again with his mother's death.
Oh, and I just thought one thing that is kind of wild in both versions of the movie is how you have this child who becomes an orphan, you know, at a very young age in the middle of Africa, and then they just grow up in Africa with no parents, and it's just never talked about.
Well, in the original, her father had only died 6 months before, so she was in her mid-teens when he passed, not as young as she was in mm-hmm. the remake. But
right, right.
And you can tell that she was raised by the community in the remake.
Uh-huh.
Because, mm-hmm. I mean, there's a big community there, and that's very involved with the conservation and raising her.
True.
Well, it takes a village.
Well put.
that's true.
Cheesy.
Where do you
well
think
put.
That came from?
I didn't know it was this movie.
You know, we are only one step away from friends are closer than family.
It takes a village.
It does. That's where that saying comes from.
Well, much like the original film, she is wooed by the safety of Joe and the encroaching poachers' threat back on the land. So to keep Joe safe, Greg, who was already had hired some pretty dodgy people through Pindi, mm-hmm. he was only after samples where they were like, hey, we can get some stuff on the side. So he's trying to control these poachers from poaching while he can do his scientific research, which does lead to some misunderstandings.
Yeah.
That was the first encounter with Joe, who frees that lion, as you mentioned earlier.
Exactly. Well, and what brought me, when I was watching the whole poachers thing, I'm like, here's the first rule when you're working with poachers. If you don't want them shooting things, you insist they give you their ammo. Don't leave them with any. Make sure they don't have any.
They're also there for protection, I imagine, as well.
I don't care. If I'm not there for you to shoot stuff, they're just going to shoot shit. They can do it for more money. He paid them off to get them to chase Joe. You just have to pay enough and they'll do it.
Yeah, fair. I wonder how many people do that and they're never heard from again.
Probably. But, well, if you're the one with all the ammo, what the fuck are they going to do?
Well, and he does take all their ammo. He's like, he doesn't let them have guns. He only has his tranquilizer darts and his tranquilizer guns, right? So
there's certain points like he doesn't want them to shoot without telling him. So again, you can't control these guys. Don't give them any weapons. They suck.
Well, there's that great scene where he's like, what is that guy doing when he's getting the clamp and he's trying to clamp Joe? It's like, what the fuck are you thinking? There's no way that you're going to stop a 2-ton gorilla with your beat up ass Jeep.
Absolutely.
It was fun to watch, though. I will say that.
Yeah.
And I liked how he takes out the Jeep with the chain. That was really brilliantly done. Well, and the guy's like, he almost took my head off. And Bill Paxton's like, yeah, wasn't it great?
Oh, that's where we see like that ape is a lot smarter than the average ape and is far more humanized, because that's some clever planning there.
Yeah, and the hide and seek. I really enjoyed the whole hide and seek mm-hmm. throughout the movie and how it played into his arrival in America, where he's playing hide and seek with David Paymer's character, but David Paymer doesn't know. So he's terrified and he's just so beat up from being so afraid. I thoroughly enjoyed that. That was like, and there were moments in the original that sort of uplifted you a little bit so that you didn't feel as angry all the way through. Right. And I did enjoy that. It made it a little less sloggy for me.
The original one?
Yeah, no, the remake.
Remake.
Mm. Yeah. Cause even though it's 20 minutes longer, it doesn't feel quite as long. Not at least to me.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's just perception there, where I think Jeff and I would probably disagree because we both enjoyed the original more.
Yeah, I kind of felt the original one was a lot more whimsical. Like the remake was definitely much darker.
Yeah, like I think story-wise, the remake is a better story.
Yeah.
But there's just something really magical about that 49 and just the simplicity of how they told stories. I mean, it would definitely, story-wise, it isn't as solid, but there's something that's still very watchable about it all. And I'll be happy to rewatch that one over the remake any day, although they both look great. So
absolutely. Mm-hmm. Actually, that's one thing that I'm going to mention for anyone out there. If you do want to watch any of these, I did find Mighty Joe Young, the original. It's on archive.org. There's like a public domain version you can find pretty easily.
Oh, that's where I found it, too.
Yeah, that's because it's RKO, which isn't around anymore, but Disney had a distribution deal back then with RKO, and Disney's the one who released the remake, and you can find that one on Disney Plus.
Yeah, absolutely.
So they also made a nod to RKO at the beginning when you open the opening credits. They have the RKO logo, and I loved that. Mm-hmm. That was great. Really nice.
Yeah, I kind of miss that RKO logo and the dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee.
Yeah.
It always reminds me of Rocky Horror.
I wish they would re-release that label, make it a Disney label or something. That would be pretty cool. RKO had a great library of stuff, so, and I'm sure it's been parted out to the three winds at this point.
Well, I did notice that, it could just be that I haven't seen them in a long time, but on Disney Plus, all of the older cartoons open up with, distributed by RKO.
Ooh. Yeah, I've been watching a lot of those animated Walt Disney's as well, and they had a distribution deal with Walt Disney. It makes me wonder if maybe they wound up getting some of that library because of that distribution deal once RKO folded.
Yeah, it's cool because I don't remember them opening with that on any of the home video releases.
Yeah, no, well, I don't know. I don't think I have any of those old video releases. Oh, I might have a couple. I don't remember either. That stuff predates all of us by a long shot, so even in my brain, I'm like, did they always have that, or didn't they? I don't remember, but it's nice to see that stuff coming out in its original form, and I'm glad these movies still exist.
Me too. One thing I actually really loved is me and Leah were just in California not too long ago, and it was really awesome seeing all of the sights, and I just love seeing Hollywood depicted in movies forever and always, but there's not a lot that actually feature the Chinese theater in as many shots. Like, they really feature it quite a lot, which is really fun.
It was very prominent, yeah. I love watching, like, the old vehicles and stuff from that era. I really loved that old van, the Great Western shipping van. Was just, what a gorgeous vehicle that was. Mm-hmm. All the vehicles were awesome, but I love those old cars. So seeing that period, those cars are way cooler than what we've got now.
Yeah, you know, the late 90s was truly great.
Late 90s. I'm 49.
I know.
Those late 90s vehicles were awful. That one guy who was driving like an asshole in the sports car.
That was like an 80s Camaro.
Yeah. That was, and then when I saw it, I'm like, ugh, that's awful. What a horrible looking vehicle.
And it was pea yellow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
On top of it all.
P-yellow.
Oh, but what I have to say about the old 40s vehicles, it's much more handy to have a giant gorilla to help you get out of a sticky situation with a tire.
Oh, yeah.
Because you can lift the truck up. It would be much harder otherwise.
Yeah, when they get stuck in the mud there and then the cops get stuck. And yeah. Not so easy for them.
Nope. And then Max O'Hara is just sitting by the side going, I'm not going to fucking help you.
Yeah, that was good. I'm surprised he didn't get charged or anything. He was just back to work.
I think he's just wealthy.
A few weeks later, yeah.
And when you're wealthy, you don't get charged with shit, apparently.
Yeah, he had his door. His door.
That is America.
His door was set with, like, super promoter.
You know, yep. I feel like if I was ever to become a wrestling promoter, I would just try to emulate that man.
Well, I think that he does. I think that McMahon does.
Yeah, you're right. He just ignores massive problems that he has, throws money at things, and
is way over the top.
Yeah, and is in over his head all of the time.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, anything else you guys want to talk about here? We did talk about that final scene in the park that kind of emulates the burning orphanage. The park goes up in the same way, and we have this kid at the top of the Ferris wheel who didn't get off with everybody else. And it was nice to see, like, the park attendant, instead of, like, most movies where he just fucking runs away,
yeah,
he actually was getting people off.
Yeah, him and Bill Paxton were working together.
Well, maybe not getting people off.
Getting people off the ride. What people
do—that's not much better.
What people do.
This is Disney we're talking about.
What people do on the ride is their own business.
Rescuing people from the ride.
Oh boy. You know, one thing, just as a storytelling point that I really liked or thought that was effective was I liked how the audience, us as the audience, knew who the villain was. And Joe knew who the villain was, but he couldn't tell anyone. And then you have Greg being the hero, hand over Jill being the heroine over to the mouth of the lion. And she doesn't know until she's, you know, in a car on a freeway. And then she has that realization. And I thought that just for dramatic tension, that was really, really well done.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah,
it was totally. good writing there.
Yeah, totally.
There's one other thing that's really different between the two movies, too, is at the beginning, you have the murder of Ruth. And at the end, you actually do have the death of the villain, right? Mm-hmm. Which is, I mean, and in the original, there are no deaths at all, aside from the one off screen where her father had died 6 months prior, but it was
all. Well, it is the '90s.
Yeah. And it is Disney, right? Disney's totally unafraid to use death to dramatic effect. The whole Disney thing of the villain, it's very much the Universal Monsters thing where the villain must die.
Yeah, yeah. That was actually the only time we do see a death on screen in either of these movies is when Joe just tosses Strasser, and he goes into the power lines and then falls into Transformer. Yeah, he gets electrocuted on the Transformer in the park.
Well, I mean, that's the man who killed his mother. That's the man who killed his best friend's mother. And it's the man who's about to kill his best friend.
Yeah.
Yep. He's asking for it.
Wrong ape to cross.
Yeah, I mean, even his henchman, Garth, was like, hey, I'm all for killing animals, but this is ridiculous. You want to kill a human being? Like, no, I'm not being party to murder. I'm like, well, you are always a murderer, but okay.
completely forgetting that he'd shot and killed somebody at the beginning of the movie 12 years prior.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And then, Strasser tries to justify it even then. It's like, well, if you're getting in the way of a hunt, that's your problem.
And then you have all this like kind of corruption where Strasser's like somehow many years later sort of established himself. No, no, I have a conservation place. No, you don't, you big fat liar.
Well, nobody looked into it. Why didn't nobody look into it?
Well, there wasn't as much internet research you could do in the 90s, apparently.
Yes.
Well, you know, they're. I mean, the late 90s. When did that movie come out? Like 98?
Yeah. 98, yeah.
The internet, you know, they're. Windows was already onto Windows 98. Like, the World Wide Web was in its infancy.
The Space Jam website was new.
It was. You know, people were still getting AOL, you know, here's the internet for free and a box of cereal for 30 days.
Oh, I remember that. Yes.
Now, the original may have made a little bit of money or at least broke even. The Disney remake, not so lucky. It was budgeted at $90 million.
Wow. So
it was a very expensive movie to shoot. Mm-hmm. And it had an opening weekend of $10.6 million with a gross of a little over $50 million. So
unfair.
Still making money. Yeah. Still trying to make its budget back 22 years later.
Very unfair.
It seems unlikely we'll ever see a third attempt at this because it's never been a profitable film. Period. And it's strange because they are, I think, both very good films.
Yeah, I would agree, actually. I was saying to Leah that the remake especially, I feel, is actually like almost criminally underrated. Like, it stars Charlize Theron and Bill Paxton. The special effects are as good as you could ever hope for. Like, it's a pretty good movie for a movie that no one ever talks about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No, it is
a
solid remake.
I think it still has relevance.
Yeah, and Jay said early on that this is exactly what we ask a remake to do, is take the original story and do something new with it. And they did exactly that, and they did it well.
I'd agree with that. Yeah, they did it very well. And we both seem to be split down the middle, where Jeff and I are leaning towards the original. Even though we recognize the story isn't as strong, it seems like you and Trish are leaning a little bit more to the remake side.
Yeah. Well,
I've gone on record numerous times saying that I tend to not gravitate towards these classic films. I just never really do enjoy them as much. I've had some very pleasant surprises, but yeah, I'm kind of, for somebody who's not a millennial or a hipster, I would kind of gravitate towards the newer stuff, even though I respect the artistry of the original. I just think that in terms of just overall story, I do think that the remake is stronger.
Yeah, and maybe for me, I have sort of those tinted glasses of, I like watching the early foundations of cinema and special effects, and the filmmaker in me that loves process likes seeing the evolution of story and the evolution of camera work and the evolution of effects. And you can see that early heyday of how hard they tried. Like, they tried so hard. You know, every now and again, I watch a movie from that era or even earlier and go, damn, it's amazing they pulled that off, because, you know, they shouldn't have been, but they did it because they didn't know they couldn't. You know, they found a way, and it's through sometimes simple means. And stop motion was a very time-consuming process. The effects for that original film was 14 months, I do believe, like a year and change. Wow. And it's no wonder it had such a high budget to put that together. So it took a long time to put out that film, which would normally, when studios are cranking films out, I mean, you look at any of those actors at that time in that movie, and they had like between 4 to 8 movies in the year.
Yeah.
So they were cranking those things out. So, you know, I always had an appreciation for seeing that, and I tend to forgive its flaws as well.
I agree. But I'm in the same camp.
Because, yeah, story-wise, there was a much simpler way of telling stories back then. There was the mics were stationary most of the time. They had to hide them on sets and things like that because they were too big to put on booms and whatnot. But they still found a way. It's amazing how much that movie moves and what you're seeing. And if you can appreciate it from the film standpoint and forgive some of the hackneyed script flaws with it, it's still a very enjoyable movie. And generally, the stuff that the original writer of the story, Marion C. Cooper, the stuff he didn't like, I didn't like either, you know, where the classic studio interference.
Yeah. It goes all the way back to the dawn of filmmaking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
I guess, and we're talking like how we're both like the things that we love the most about movies. And you're very much the process, but I'm kind of also like the story as well. And I could feel like some of those notes that didn't get done in the original, finding those in the remake and really getting that feeling that something better has happened. And it was just, I don't know, to me, the remake, I think I lean towards it because it's like there's more magic to it, more wonder. It watches really well. Like, there's a wholesomeness I feel like I could just enjoy again and again.
In a way, it does feel like a more, even more so than the original film, a more family oriented film. And maybe sometimes that works against it, but plot wise, story wise, it takes a lot of the kind of haphazard elements of the original film and meshes it into the story in a much more clear narrative. And that I'd kind of like, because, you know, that ending with the fire just feels tacked on, and it's really long. and
it came
now,
out of nowhere.
It literally comes out of nowhere. They drive by it. It's like, there it's a fire. We need to stop and see if need.
Like,
forget we're on the lam right now. We got to stop and rescue some kids. It just comes out of nowhere, left field, and the way they still kept an ending that really wasn't very satisfactory in the original film and meshed it in a much more satisfying and logical way, and we get a much more exciting trip with Mighty Joe Young going through the streets of Los Angeles to get to this park in the first place. So there's a logic to it of why he's drawn there, and it's developed within the body of the story, and you still get a similar set piece, but it watches a lot better because it doesn't come out of nowhere. And it does have some of its out of nowhere gags as well that just feel like they're inserted at the last minute.
It sort of feels to me like the 1949 one. I guess what I really enjoyed was actually, I kind of wanted Joe to stay in Africa and just watch all that stop motion animation there. I don't know why. Just eliminate all the terrible people and just have Joe's adventures on his island by himself.
But the terrible people's the message of the film. So
I know.
You kind of need it.
It just got so hard at the end, especially when they're throwing stuff at Joe and they're like, if he picks it up, you win. I was just so nauseated by that bit.
Mm-hmm. But at the same time,
I almost had to stop it. I had to stop it for a bit and watch something else because I was
Kudos to the filmmakers. They got to you. They made you angry and you were supposed to be.
I know.
And I like them both. Like I said, I hated watching them, but I like them both.
Yeah, well, if you're sensitive to the mistreatment of animals, you're definitely going to hate this.
I mean, Amelia really, really loved them, and yeah, not a fan of mistreatment of animals. And
yeah, everybody gets a message, and it affects them differently.
Yeah. And I've already gone on record saying that I do not enjoy the feeling of being angry. And I try to avoid movies that make me feel angry. I will turn them off under normal circumstances. If I start to get angry, I will stop watching, because it's an emotion that I don't like in other people, and I don't like it in myself.
Well, I have that when I watch those angry moments, hoping I'll see that moment of redemption for a character, or that change of that realization that we've put this creature, specifically Joe Young, in a bad situation, and we'll get a better outcome. And that's part of the arc of story.
Yeah, but I think there's this one thing that I have, and I guess it's my own glasses that are on this, especially now in today's world, is when I watch irredeemable people on screen, I don't have any hope they will learn their lesson, even watching movies. But I had to say, in the 1994-91, I was so surprised when they went with a happy ending. I couldn't believe it.
You know, I was generally surprised too, because of, you know, the ending of King Kong and even earlier films like Frankenstein and Creature from the Black Lagoon, where you have the misunderstood monster always dying at the end. And I'm like, oh no, not this one too. That was my first thought, was like, God damn it. Like, you desperately want the ape to survive all this horribleness and see a better outcome. And thankfully, they give it to us.
It is touted as a family film, and it is. It is a great movie that you could watch with your kids or your nieces or nephews or your grandparents without feeling uncomfortable by the narrative in either movie. And I like that about it. Like I said, there's lots to like about both these movies, and I do like them. I wasn't surprised that they kept him alive. I was actually expecting them to, because it is supposed to be a family film.
So is Old Yeller.
Fair enough.
It was like kind of what I was thinking earlier with, like, you know, after a decade, a little bit more than a decade after making King Kong, it does really feel like, you know, you think about exactly what Jay was talking about, where there's a lot of movies where the monster does die at the end, and it's this tragedy. And with Mighty Joe Young, they really, really rush him to get to the theater, to the place that King Kong was, so that took him the whole movie to get to. Kind of in a way that it does feel like, you know, a little bit of a what if, where, you know, King Kong is, you know, in chains, and, you know, he's made to do a show for multiple weeks, and the New York thing doesn't happen. And it really does feel like the alternate ending, or like the after a decade of sitting on a story that you wrote, kind of writing a nicer resolution just for you. Mighty Joe Young felt a lot more personal, I think, than King Kong.
I kept wondering if it might be like an East Coast, West Coast gripe. They're like, you know what? If we have a big ape in L.A., we're not going to kill him. Take that, New York.
West side.
Oh, boy.
That was sort of the other message I got from it.
Yeah, that should be the takeaway, everyone.
Kill animals, but L.A., we're totally down.
We're so easy going in L.A., yeah, it's cool.
Yeah, we see crazy stuff all the time, man. It's the place where movies are made.
Yeah.
All right, any last thoughts about Mighty Joe Young?
I liked it, and I'm really glad that doing this podcast gave me an excuse to watch both of them. It was a really nice double feature to do in a day.
Yeah, I did it over the course of a couple of days, but I really enjoyed both of them. Yeah.
My takeaway is like that point where in the remake where Charlize Theron is just being cradled there by Joe, I was like going, that looks nice.
Mm-hmm. Well, even when Bill Paxton was just calming Joe when he's in the cage, or this, they're holding hands, and this was that after a moment where Joe, you can see that, oh no, this guy I trusted has betrayed me. Just momentarily where they trank him in the park. But it winds up being a trusting, if not forgiving, scene where Joe's like, I get it.
Yeah.
We're still friends.
You're not one of the guys. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's something to enjoy for both of these films for sure.
But I'd like to be, I guess I would say is, don't take this. This is not a euphemism. I would just like to be cuddled by a giant ape. That's what I'm getting at. Maybe it's because I haven't had human contact for so long, but that seemed to speak to me.
Take what you can get.
Exactly.
Well, that was Mighty Joe Young from 1949 and 1998, and part of our April Apocalypse. And we've got two more episodes to give you of more simian fun for the month of April, and we'll be happy to do so. This is a great departure from what we usually do, so it's fun to have these kind of weird themes that we're doing this month.
Kind of feel like all the time everybody is trying to find a different genre, you know, something. We all watch horror, or it's comedy, or genres we're all very familiar with, and it's fun to find, you know, ape as a genre.
I was like going through our back catalog to try and find other ape-themed or ape movies that had apes in them. It was really hard. We only have two or three other episodes that where there's apes present.
King Kong being the most obvious one.
And then there's Trading Places. It was about the only other one that I could find. But yeah, it's still fun to look. It's nice that we're now adding more to our catalog.
Yeah.
There is enough for multiple years for sure.
Yeah. And we'll continue to do so for you each and every week on Invasion of the Remake, even during these uncertain times. We hope we are bringing you some comfort and entertainment with these episodes. We know they're going to sound a little different. We got a little cameo by Leah this week in the background. If you heard, you probably heard her during this episode. She says hi, by the way.
There's one other thing I wanted to touch on before we go. I think for like those ones where we're going to make up stories for what the title was, in the background of the original, I want to know what Earthquake Ballet is.
Oh,
that's what Max O'Hara had as a poster. It was called Earthquake Ballet.
That's right.
I need to know.
The poster changed too when he was changing his
underwater
theme.
Underwater babies.
Underwater babies, and then his next nightclub was going to have an aquatic theme to it. So, but yeah, we can make up two fictional posters in it within a film too.
Yeah.
Who knows? Maybe those exist. We'll have to IMDb them.
Exactly. But yeah, that was one of my unanswered questions. I was like, we got to figure this out, guys.
And if you have a suggestion, even corrections, comments, or just want to chat with us, you can do it on our social media at Invasion Remake on Twitter, Invasion of the Remake on Facebook and Instagram, and Invasion of the Remake at gmail.com. Don't forget to give us a 5-star rating and a short review if you are inclined to do so. If you enjoy the show, it'll help get more
earballs
on the show. Yeah, please send in your fan challenges. You can also catch us on YouTube. I've noticed more YouTube subscribers as of late. I guess people aren't picking up their phones because they're not commuting right now. So there's more subscribers happening on YouTube. Not the best place to see us, but you can always put us in the background while you're making dinner or something, and or cleaning or whatnot. We're great for that. And whatever works for you. Our new episodes drop on YouTube every Thursday, and make sure you give us a subscribe and ring that bell for notifications and like those episodes while you're there.
Hey, I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
What if we posted our videos on Pornhub? Do you think we get more activity that way?
Ooh,
that's a really good question.
That's when they post those trailers from Comic-Con.
I hear they have spiked quite a bit right now.
That's why I thought of it. It's like, what if we did?
And I'm wondering, they just donated a whole bunch of masks. I'm like, why were you sitting on those? Where did you get those?
I have a question too. Of all our catalog, I really fear on Pornhub, any which way but loose.
That one might get a lot of hits.
I was thinking, yes.
I should send our host site Libsyn. I'm like, hey, can you give us an automatic pump to Pornhub? Pump the Pornhub.
Oh, Jay.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
Pump to Pornhub.
As Jeff said,
isn't that
earlier,
what we all do?
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, dear God. Cabin fever is definitely setting in. It's only going to get weirder from here. Apologize.
That's my secret, Captain. I'm weird all the time.
Well, with April, we could just change some of like our search terms, like just like a hairy good time or something.
I think we're starting to go a little bananas.
Yeah. Oh, no. All right. I got to get out of here. I've been Jason.
I'm always Sam.
And I continue to be Trish.
And I always come back as Jeff.
And we are out of here.
Dear Cecily, I promised to write you when Joe was settled, and now I finally can. With all the contributions people sent in for Joe, we were able to buy a beautiful land preserve that's even big enough for him. Who dedicated the Joe Young Wildlife Park today, and it was one of the happiest days of my life. At last, I have kept my promise to my mother. The people here are saying Engaizamu, the sacred guardian, has returned to protect the mountains. Other people still say Engaizamu is just a legend. I say, legends live forever.